Thank you, Jim. Well, good morning, and thank you for being here. Thank you for being here at Minnesota Zen Center and here on the planet. That's important. Here you are. You don't know how you got here. It had something to do with your mother and your father. But now you're here. And you're here this morning. And that's great. So this morning I want to kind of weave together some themes. So I'm struck by how creative this process is, just being a human being. It's a creative process to practice Zen, actually. Maybe we don't think of it as creative, but it actually is. It's a creative process. We create our life through our practice, and our practice through our life. And recently, I've been inspired by three characters. So I'm going to talk about these three characters. John Francis, also known as the Planet Walker, the sixth patriarch, Hui Ning, and Ryokan. And the themes are the power of silence, seeing the good in others, and cultivating sympathetic joy. Tim mentioned a source of great joy for me, and that is playing with children and playing with balance. And Ryokan also played with children. It's one of the things I like about him. So I'll start out with a story, and I told this yesterday, so those of you who were here yesterday will hear it again. So this year on Earth Day, my husband and I went to hear a talk in a small town near us, about 35 miles away. That's near where we live. And it was in Gays Mills, Wisconsin, which was flooded out and covered in water in 2009 and has been rebuilt with disaster funds and has a nice new community center on higher ground. And we went to hear a speaker called John Francis talk about his experience of giving up driving in cars. In 1971, he started this practice of giving up, renouncing driving in cars. And then shortly after that, he also stopped speaking. He renounced speech. So for 17 years, he didn't drive in cars. And for 18 years, he didn't speak. He wrote notes, but he didn't speak. And the inspiration, the reason for his doing this was that he lived near San Francisco in a smaller town. I forgot the name of it now. And with his girlfriend, he's an African-American man. He's now 68. Back then, he was 27 years old in 1971. And two oil tankers collided in the San Francisco Bay, creating a huge oil spill that really created a lot of damage and destruction. And he was very moved by that. He was very moved by that. And he decided, you know, it was kind of an awakening for him. He decided, I'm not going to drive in cars anymore. And he told his girlfriend, and she wasn't very happy about that, because she said, well, I need to drive in cars. I have to do this. And he said, well, that's okay, but I'm not going to do it anymore. So his friends, you know, would actually... So he started walking everywhere, and his friends would drive up in their cars and start arguing with him. You know, you can't do this. What sense does this make? This doesn't make any difference. You'll make no difference in the problem that you're trying to address by not driving in a car. So he found himself arguing with his friends a lot, you know, about that. And pretty soon he decided he couldn't believe what he was doing with his speech, and he decided that he would just stop speaking as well as stop driving cars. So needless to say, pretty eccentric individual. He took up playing the banjo to give himself something to do on his long walks everywhere. And he met a lot of people. And they were curious about what he was doing. And they'd take him home and feed him. And well, they wouldn't take him. They'd drive and then he'd follow on foot and get there hours later wherever they lived, you know. And he crisscrossed the country several times. And he got 3 degrees while he was practicing this vow. He got his bachelor's at some school in California that gave you a lot of credit for walking around, I guess. This is according to him. And he got his master's and finally his PhD at the University of Wisconsin. I think environmental science. And his parents lived in inner city Philadelphia. And they weren't happy either when they found out about his vow of silence and his vow not to drive in cars. Although they, after a while, they were kind of glad that he didn't drive in cars because it was really hard for them to visit them, and they didn't know how they would tell their friends about his lifestyle, so they were kind of happy that he couldn't come visit. But his father would fly to see him with every new accomplishment, and each time he would say, "You know, John, this is great, you know, you got your master's, but you still don't talk and you still don't drive in cars and you're not ever going to amount to anything. You're not going to be able to get a job." His dad kept saying this to him. Well, also being very supportive, coming to see him. And so that was a theme, this support from his father. And his father's eyes continually opening at what is the crazy things that would happen to his son as a result of taking these vows. So finally, the U of Wisconsin, Madison, contacted him and said, we heard you're looking for a place to do your PhD, and we think you should come here because no place else could handle you. So he actually taught classes in silence. He was a great storyteller. He mainly told stories. He didn't talk about his efforts to save the planet so much as he told stories. And the first thing he said to break his silence at the 20-year anniversary of Earth Day in Washington, D.C., where he was invited to come, was, "Thank you for being here." So. And he said that to us, and when he said it, it just brought tears to my eyes. There was so much love and joy coming from him. So I told one of my friends, it was one of the best Dharma talks I've been to in a while. So that's John's story. And he has a book out called Planet Walker, and another one out called The Ragged Edge of Silence, if you're interested in checking him out. So, here at Zen Center, we're attempting to practice Buddhism in a way that fits, and teach it in a way that fits our lives in this age. Stephen Batchelor has a definition for that. He calls it secular Buddhism, and the meaning of secular, he says, is of this age. Of this age. And so, along with Zazen and sutra study and ceremonies and retreats, we're trying to integrate practices from broader Buddhist traditions. We're borrowing from other traditions. We teach loving kindness meditation now and encourage people to practice that, and mindfulness. So it's different. It's different than when I started out. It's all about just sitting, Zazen, and it's still all about that. But it's also about integrating other practices. So today I want to talk a little bit, along with talking about these guys that inspire me and their teachings, I want to talk about sympathetic joy, the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes, which are loving kindness, equanimity, compassion, and sympathetic joy. So, but first I want to talk a little bit about Weining, the sixth ancestor of Zen. And I am giving a class in July here, teaching a class on the Zen ancestors, including Weining and others. So I hope you'll come to that. I think the ancestors still have a lot to share with us. And the mythic stories of their lives. There's a lot of truth in myth. So one of the major teaching of Weining, the Platform Sutra is attributed to him, and really has inspired all the lineages of Zen, and even in some of the Tibetan lineages revere Weining and the Platform Sutra. And in it are stories of his life and his teachings, which basically make up the bulk of Zen teaching. They're in the Platform Sutra. And a good friend of mine turned me on to this excerpt from the Platform Sutra, and it's called The Song of Formlessness. So I'll read it to you. It addresses our tendency to see what's wrong in the world and in others. People who truly follow the way don't consider the faults of the world. Those who consider the wrongs of the world only add to their own. I don't condemn the faults of others. My own are what I'm after. Just get rid of thoughts about wrongs and all your afflictions will shatter. So when he talks about the way, I think he's referencing, you know, the way, the path of Zen, the Tao maybe, but also the perfection of wisdom, Prajnaparamita. And he takes total responsibility for his thoughts and his views. You know, that's his radical responsibility, and it's ours too. To take total responsibility for how we see, for our perceptions, our thoughts, our views. And that aids the development of wisdom, prajna. And also the increasing ability to open up and be here in a non-dualistic way and experience the joy of the moment unfolding and of impermanence. So, we often associate impermanence with something kind of like sadness and loss, but there's a real joy to it too, right? The fact that flowers are so fresh, the fact that you walk out today and it's so green and alive, it's beautiful because it's fleeting, it's impermanent. So how do we go about just getting rid of all of our thoughts about wrongs? Well, I think Zen offers a couple different ways to work with that, and one of them is sitting on the cushion and being with our thoughts and giving them a big pasture, a big field, seeing them, gaining insight into them, and then releasing them. So that's one way. Another way is through relationship with each other. You know? That's what life is about, really. It's about relationship with ourselves, with each other, the environment that holds us. And mindfulness of body, mind, speech, thoughts. And again, seeing into impermanence, that all helps. So it's not really possible to get rid of thoughts about wrongs, but just to let go of them and replace them with wisdom, prajna, thoughts that are that contain, if you will, virtue. And also cultivating these virtues: loving kindness, equanimity, compassion, sympathetic joy. So now I'll talk about why it's hard sometimes to engender sympathetic joy. So it is kind of hard, isn't it, to be joyful for the good fortune of others sometimes? You know, it can be kind of difficult. You know, sometimes we feel a sense of impoverishment, you know, kind of a poverty thinking about ourselves. You know, there's not enough to go around. There's not enough joy to go around. I'm not feeling enough joy. How can I possibly engender it for somebody else? I'm tired. Maybe you're a caregiver for an elderly person or for your partner, and you're just exhausted from caregiving. So how to engender sympathetic joy when you're exhausted? Another difficulty is just, you know, the speed of our life. You know, the speed of our life and the envy factor. And oddly, you know, I love Facebook, you know, well, up to a point. I like it. And I think social networking is positive. But I also think that it can increase the envy factor, you know. Trolling through your friends' status updates and looking at all their accomplishments, the vacation they just went on, the pictures, you know, that can increase our sense of, well, everybody else has it better than we do. And also, people, you know, research shows that people who spend a lot of time on the internet and on social networking sites spend less time face to face with others. They can spend less time face to face. It's sort of a pseudo intimacy. And really, what you're looking at is the persona of your friends. Have you ever noticed that? I kind of gave up Facebook for a while because I thought, this is just exhausting, you know? It's like creating a persona all the time. What a drag, you know? I mean, you know, there's still pictures on there and, you know, a few things, but and I think that it's also good for keeping in touch with people, but there's aspects of it that I think don't go with so much with practicing the Dharma. So I think that there's reasons why we think we can't do it, but I want to encourage myself and you to do it anyway. And Sharon Salzberg is a wonderful teacher who teaches the loving-kindness practice and the divine abodes. And she said it's even possible when one is depressed or even angry to still do the practice, you know, of engendering sympathetic joy for others. And the reason for doing it is creating new neural pathways. Brain science shows, you know, the research shows that by practicing something, we create these connections, and areas of our brain can be developed. So they've done a lot of, they've not done a lot, but they've started to do research, and Richard Davidson in Wisconsin has done research on mindfulness practice and doing brain scans, and they see thickening in areas of the brain that are connected to altruism and compassion. So it's possible that even when it seems like it's kind of fakey at first, or we're kind of pretending with these practices, if we keep at it, I think the research shows we'll create a greater capacity And why do we want to do it? Because it helps us. It helps us to extend sympathetic joy, loving kindness, compassion to others helps us. And it's easier to sit down on the cushion when you feel some measure of joy. It's easier to practice that renunciation for that period of time on the cushion when you feel like it's at least possible to engender feelings of loving kindness for yourself and others, and joy for yourself and others. Just like, following good ethical practices help us to sit on the cushion. We're not distracted by our guilt then, or our regrets. We're able to just be here for a period of time. So there's a lot of benefits. There's three types of sympathetic joy. Joy in the good fortune of others, that my friend here has a favorable position. He's done with his training. He got Dharma transmission. He's free. I'm so happy for him. So that's one type of sympathetic joy. And I already talked about the barrier to that. Another form is joy in the goodness and virtue of others. So instead of looking at someone who has a lot of goodness and just radiates it and you can feel it from them and thinking, oh, I can never be like that. You're just so happy that they can be like that, because being around them makes you feel better. And they're just radiating, they're just increasing the overall joy in the field that we live in. So a loving parent, grandparent, visualizing a mentor, a beloved teacher, somebody like Suzuki Roshi, bringing him to mind, or Katagiri Roshi, or whoever in your life really saw the good in you and believed in you, calling those people to mind is a way of engendering the joy of the goodness and virtues of others. And altruistic joy is engendering joy to benefit others. So that's like setting an intention to consciously cultivate the joy to benefit others. So it's like when we sit down and do loving kindness meditation and extend that. First we do it for ourselves and then extend it to someone neutral, or someone that we love and have no problems with, someone neutral, someone who's a little bit challenging for us, and then somebody who's really challenging for us, and then extending it out to the entire universe. That's the sequence of generating those qualities. So even in the midst of suffering, I find myself practicing this. It's probably why I'm interested in talking about it today. In my role as a chaplain, even with dying people, you can engender sympathetic joy. And dying people are just people, They're just people. They're just people that are at this gate. They're at a doorway, and they're often marginalized, but they're very much still present, and often, especially if when they're mentally clear, and it brings them a lot of joy, to review their life with them, and sort of revel in the good things they did, the good deeds that they did for others in this life. It brings them a lot of comfort and joy. So I know someone recently said to me, I don't see any comfort in Zen. I don't see any comfort in Buddhism. But I think there is the comfort that we can bring to others, and that when we do that, it does something for us too, So that's like bearing witness, we bear witness, you know, in this example of the dying person, working with a dying person, of course I'm bearing witness to their sadness and to their, maybe their pain, maybe they have some suffering, maybe they have regrets, I don't know, whatever it is. I'm certainly there to witness that, but I can also extend the joy that I have of being still alive with them in that moment and being in that as it unfolds, because that's what we have. We have the present moment, which contains everything in it. It's all there. And as it unfolds, we can see that and we can be with it without analyzing it. And we can offer that to someone else, the joy of that. You know, what does that involve? It might, you know, sitting at the bedside of a dying person. For me, when I was in hospice, you know, it might be dying in spring. There might be sunlight coming through the window and softly landing and turning the whole space golden. There might be the sounds of laughing children outdoors that bring to mind memories for the person of their own children. And we explore those, you know, all kinds of things. The smell of the lilacs, you know. So engendering sympathetic joy is even possible in situations that we can't imagine it's being possible. And I think that for me now, this practice is pretty important. It's not some giddiness. It's not that kind of joy. And it's not pleasure. It's not something about self-indulgence, you know. But it involves a bit of renunciation on my part. But it is a deeply abiding kind of joy. And everyone's capable of experiencing it and also offering it out there. So a third person I want to bring up today, share some with you about, is Ryokan, the 17th century wandering poet monk who was the eldest son of his family and left the family to become a monk and then a wandering poet monk that his teacher named Great Fool. When he received Inca, when he received Dharma transmission from his teacher gave him a staff for wandering and wrote him a poem, referring to him as Great Fool. And that was a big compliment. It was a big compliment on the part of his teacher. Ryokan's heroes were Dogen Zenji. Some of you know about Dogen, and you're studying Dogen and some of Dogen's work in the study group right now. Ryokan revered Dogen, but he also revered a bodhisattva from the Lotus Sutra called the Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. Ryokan studied language, and he was also big on silence. He didn't advocate sort of idle speech and gossip. He thought that he taught, and he felt that speech and language, although capable of art and poetry, was also could be very destructive. And he once wrote a list of reminders to himself, and one of them was, once spoken, a word can't be called back. And here's something that Ryokan wrote about that. Talk is always easy, practice always hard. It's no wonder people try to make up for their lack of hard practice with easy talk. But the harder they try, the worse things get. The more they talk, the more wrong they go. It's like pouring on oil to put out a fire. Just foolishness and nothing else. So that's one side of Ryokan. He wasn't all sweet mellowness. He could be really tough. But he was also very tender. He was extremely tender. Here's a poetic tribute to the Bodhisattva, never disparaging. Day and night you practice, bowing and bowing again. You live your life simply practicing bowing. I take refuge in you, never despising anyone. You stand alone, without a peer, above or under heaven. Some throw stones, some beat him with sticks. He retreats, then stops and calls to them aloud. Since this fellow has left the world, no one has heard from him. But the wind and moonlight that fill the night, for whom do they reveal their purity? There was no one like you in the past, there will be no one like you in the future. Never disparaging, never despising anyone. Your pureness makes me forever adore you. So, before my Dharma transmission ceremony with Tim, I talked to a friend of mine about some of my nervousness about the process, and she said, I said, what is this supposed to mean, Dharma transmission? And she said, you just need to become never disparaging anyone, Bodhisattva. So this Bodhisattva was supposed to have been a previous incarnation of Shakyamuni Buddha, and his teaching was not through words but through constantly making prostrations in front of people to express his sense that to honor their Buddha nature and to encourage them, because he felt that they were sure to become a Buddha in the future. And even when they threw stones at him, even monks and nuns threw stones at him, he would stand at the edge of town calling, I know you're going to become a Buddha in the future. It's pretty funny, isn't it? So, Ryokan was a character, both tough and tender. And there's a story that was written by, it was actually kept going, and I'm probably going to end pretty soon for those of you who are feeling kind of squirmy. Ryokan's brother's family passed this story down orally. It was written down by the descendants of the Yamamoto family, which was Ryokan's family name. Ryokan's nephew, Umanosuke, also known as Yasuki, Yoshiyuki's first son and the heir to the declining Yamamoto clan, had begun to indulge in a life of dissipation and would not listen to anyone's advice. In desperation, his mother, Yasuko, asked Ryokan to admonish him. Ryokan went to the family's house and stayed there for 3 days, yet he remained speechless, not knowing what to say to his nephew. Finally, when the time came for Ryokan to leave, he called his nephew over to help him tie his straw sandals. Thinking that Ryokan was at last about to begin preaching to her son, Yasuko hid behind a screen. And she listened. And as the nephew was, I'm not going to try his name again, was tying Ryokan's sandals, he felt a cold sensation on his neck. Looking up, he realized it was the tears falling from Ryokan's eyes. Suddenly, Umanosuke recovered his senses. Ryokan just stood up and, still silent, departed. It's a beautiful story that is very inspiring to me. And you know, there is tenderness in our tradition. There's tenderness and mercy. And we find it in silence and in sitting still and then coming out, connecting with others from that place and really allowing others a huge pasture, a big field to live in. Ryokan didn't give advice because he not only felt tenderness, but he felt, it was well known that Ryokan felt very contrite. He felt really bad. He understood that he had abandoned his family as the eldest son and went wandering, and that his decision helped lead to the family's situation. And so he actually felt very connected to the nephew. You know, he felt like, well, we're really equals now. I'm not above you. I'm not, it's not my place to give you advice, you know. So, anyway, I'll probably end there today, but I also want to just encourage again myself and you. In Mahayana Buddhism, awakening is a process that never ends. It never ends. And one Japanese teacher, when describing rebirth, said, "What actually continues is our habit energy." So it's a good idea to work with our habit energy, you know, all through the process of awakening and beyond it, the awakening process, which never ends. So thanks. Thank you. And if you have any comments or questions, or not questions, poems you want to spontaneously recite, it's a good time for that. Today is May Day, a major holiday in the Twin Cities. I don't know what it's going to be like. We celebrate May Day in this town. Celebrated for a lot of reasons, the rebirth of the earth and to honor all the workers of the world, which is all of us, and lift up the downtrodden and celebrate new paradigms. I guess that's all part of what May Day is about. Okay.
So, you talked a little about how difficult sometimes this practice can be.
Which practice? Of engendering sympathetic joy?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, for instance. But just Buddhist practice in general. Mm-hmm. And it is difficult, I find. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I'm reading a book at this point, which has kind of transported me to a place where it must be intensely more difficult. It's a book called In the Garden of the Beasts by an author named Eric Larson. And he's talking about the family of a professor of history who Roosevelt appoints as ambassador to Germany in 1933. And he's kind of an innocent. He and his family go to Germany. Larson is describing the social situation in Germany at that point after Hitler's rise to power, not complete power. Hindenburg was still whatever he was at that point. They had the ability to dismiss him. But they had managed to inculcate in the society there denouncing neighbors, saluting each other with the Sieg Heil salute. I mean, just, you know, ordinary citizens passing each other, with saluting each other that way. And this led to a great amount of self-censorship and self-control imposed, and all these values that were coming down from outside were internalized by all the folks that you meet on the street. How difficult that situation must have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're the one who introduced me to it. That's not that you'd remember that, but. That's right. People who truly follow the way don't consider the faults of the world. Those who consider the wrongs of the world only add to their own. I don't condemn the faults of others. My own are what I'm after. Just get rid of thoughts about wrongs, and all your afflictions will shatter.
Interesting about that too. That could just as easily been said by Wei Nung as it could the Shen Sui, is that his name? The guy who wrote the other poem? They both equally could have said that. And they're sort of on the opposite sides of the story.
Mm-hmm. Shen Sui went on to, the story is that he went on and broke through and became awakened, became the patriarch of the Northern School of Buddhism. So even though he played the role of one man down in that story, he later is restored to.
And there's a legal relationship
according to the story.
Yeah.
Before you lapse into 20 years of silence,
that would be interesting. Now you've given me an idea.
You see a little bit about chaplaincy and hospice at the Dharma Gate and Buddhism and how one actually travels in that.
Well, I was saying in our small group the other day that at a certain point in my practice, I really decided that I needed to, although I would continue to do a lot of retreats and study and listen to other people's Dharma talks, I really felt the need to go out into the world and share the fruits of my practice with people, with especially people who really need the help. And I think, Guy, because impermanence for me personally has always been such a potent teaching, and the great matter of life and death that all religion seems to attempt to address really spoke to me. So hospice made sense to me. When I started my training doing it, I was pretty much the only Buddhist chaplain they'd ever seen in that program. I was the only one they'd ever seen. And so that was challenging. It was hard. It was a hard road. But now I feel I just love it. It's a great practice for putting all these practices into play, you know, and sharing my heart as well as the fruits of my practice. And I think bearing witness, you know, these are Bernie Glassman's three tenets of a peacemaker, but I think they've worked pretty well as a Buddhist theology for me, and that is not knowing. That's one of them. And healing myself and others and bearing witness. And I would add engendering sympathetic joy to that. But I think it's a fitting path. I mean, they go together well. The Buddhist path the Zen path and being a chaplain. Yeah, because, you know, the biggest thing I feel like I bring is just that, you know what? You can trust the moment that's unfolding here, you know? You can trust the moment. I try to bring that with my body and my presence, that awareness. The moment will contain everything we need, you know? So, you know, it's not that I don't honor people's beliefs, you know, and their reliance on those beliefs, but it's just that I bring, what I bring that's unique is, you know, you can trust the unfolding of the moment. Okay. One more? Hi.
That's what's intriguing to me. You can trust the unfolding of the moment. One of the things that I'm realizing in my own process is that trust is made stronger because of sort of the sense that there's an intelligence, that there's some reason that my ego and my mental configuration can't really state. So the trust is simply that, okay, I don't really know what's happening, but it's okay. The trust is a major thing for me. It's interesting to say that.
Yeah, it's pretty. That's good. I really resonate with what you're saying.
It's sort of a battle of ego. I
don't really understand. Oh. Yeah. Okay.